Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Seth Rockman, who's an associate professor of history at Brown University. He and Sven Beckert are writing a book that will be coming out next year called Slavery's Capitalism, A New History of American Economic Development. They did a piece in Bloomberg about slavery and the rise of American capitalism, which has caught our attention. Christina Arison, one of my producers, brought it to my attention, and immediately called Seth to get him on the show. He's also written a book, by the way, Scraping By, Wage Labor, Slavery, and Survival in Early Baltimore. So it has a connection here to us here in our home city as we broadcast to all of you. And Seth Rockman, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much.
So this is really fascinating. I mean, as we said a moment ago, before we went on the air, that people talk often about the rise of British capitalism and slavery, but we don't talk a lot about American capitalism and the power slavery had that was one of the core of the wealth and underpinning of our capitalist structure in America.
That's right, and that surely has a lot to do with the Civil War, right? A story that we usually understand as a industrializing North going to war against an agrarian South, and when capitalism trumps slavery in the Civil War itself, it frames a longer history, it would appear, in which these are antagonistic forces, seemingly from time immemorial, rather than forces that have almost everything to do with one another in their formative development.
So let's cover some of this. I mean, I just found the article fascinating, and I'm looking forward to the entire book when it comes out. As you just said, we see slavery as a Southern issue, but in reality, as you're talking about, it's a national issue, and was. So let's take a step backwards. Maybe you can describe it by talking a bit about, the roots of Lehman Brothers and Berkshire Hathaway that you mentioned in your article.
Yeah, both of these capture important, I suppose you can say, aspects of slavery as a national story. The story of Lehman Brothers, speaks to the South as a boomtown, or I should say booming region of the United States in its era of rapid economic development in the 19th century. For enterprising families, including immigrant families, looking for opportunities to get ahead in this country, coming to the United States in the 1830s and 1840s, there may have been a few better places than Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, for people with very little money and the benefit of having white skin to get ahead. And so families could set up there and merchandise dry goods and, of course, broker those goods for cotton, and that would connect small farmers and slaveholders in a state like Alabama to merchants like the Lehman Brothers, to centers of finance in New York, and ultimately centers of commercial development in places like Liverpool or the Boston area. So it connects, it creates a wide chain. And of course, it is New England manufacturing that gets us to the story of Berkshire Hathaway, a story which speaks to a New England industrial revolution that makes no sense without access to slave-grown cotton. It's one thing to have developed water power technology for milling textiles, but unless you have something to put through those looms and to shoot through those spindles, you don't have an industrial revolution.
So, I mean,
and of course, cotton does not grow very well in New England, it turns out.
No, it does not. It does not. But one of the things that part of what's coming to light here, I think you described briefly, and you'll describe, I'm sure, more in your book, is that the reparation lawsuits that have taken place and some of the push locally for disclosure ordinances have affected companies, as you write about, J.P. Morgan, Aetna, Wachovia, some Ivy League schools. I mean, this is part of what's opening this, for want of a better term at the moment, Pandora's box.
Well, yes, that's right. This is a case where, in fact, academic historians like myself and my colleagues are playing catch-up to a set of historical discoveries that were brought to light by activists, by institutions like museums, and by journalists writing very important exposés, like the one that the Hartford Courant did about 5 or 6 years ago, that was ultimately published under the title of Complicity, which was an entire story of how Connecticut was implemented or implicated in slavery from the very beginning of its colonial founding all the way through its 19th century industrial development.
And I think that one of the things that really struck me about the brief article the two of you put together is that you know, we have this myth, those of us who kind of look at American history, that this economic miracle of the 1800s that exploded, we always have seen it in terms of just the explosion of northern industrialism or around that, but never really understanding how it was tied to slavery of the South at the hip.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a bit about that, about how this kind of gigantic explosion and how it was really what the fundamental issues were and how it was tied to slavery. Without slavery, it wouldn't have happened.
Sure. Well, if you transfer yourself back or transport yourself back to the United States circa 1820 or 1830 and ask, what is the most valuable thing made in this country? What is the only thing that is capable of being exported to the rest of the world to create a favorable balance of trade or to bring gold and silver into the coffers of American banks? You know, you're not going to come up with a bunch of manufactured goods. You're not going to come up with some incredibly new technology like the iPad, or it's 1800 analog. You're going to settle on cotton, and cotton is, in fact, the only thing that is made in the United States that has any true market value in a global sense. And if you'll allow me another historical analogy. Cotton is the oil of the 19th century, and the United States is Saudi Arabia. We produce the bulk of the world cotton, and cotton is crucial to an industrial revolution in the world's largest economy of the time, England, that is, you know, a good 60 or 70 years ahead of that would emerge in the United States. And so to that extent, the United States has some degree of significance on the world stage, but it is ultimately as the producer of a raw material that will be transformed into greater wealth elsewhere. But what this means is that people in the United States, ranging from slaves working in cotton fields throughout the American South to merchants in crossroads villages and towns throughout the lower South, to merchants who facilitate the movement of raw cotton into the global market, some of which will come to New England and form the basis of the Industrial Revolution there. All of the ancillary industries that are connected with this, and by this I mean people in Connecticut who are making hose for slave plantations, people in New York who are offering shipping of raw cotton across the Atlantic Ocean, companies in Connecticut who are offering insurance on that freight, bankers who are speculating with their depositors' money in new plantation lands in the South, because the best way to make more money in the United States in the 1830s and 1840s, it would appear, is to buy plantations and slaves in order to grow cotton, which, again, is the only valuable thing that the United States truly makes in this period. To that extent, slavery and the cotton that slaves produce is not a Southern phenomenon. It is not a sectional phenomenon. It is a national phenomenon, and virtually everyone in the United States is somehow connected to that.
It's so much easier, I think, for people to swallow the regionalism that we've fostered in America, where this was all about the South and all about the Southern slave traders enslaving Africans on our shores. That this is, I mean, it's so much easier to swallow.
Yes, absolutely. One of the most vivid sort of representations of this as a national institution actually was put on at the New York Historical Society a few years ago in an exhibition they ran called Slavery in New York. And one of the things that they had was a TV set set up to look like a present-day financial news network, like CNBC, something like that, with the various scrolls and tickers running across the side and up and down the screen, but rather than stock prices or other information that might be useful to today's investors, it had prices of sugar, prices of rice, prices of cotton, and of course prices of slaves. It contained information about slave insurrections that might affect the viability of next year's crops. It contained information about runaway slaves, people who would need to be recaptured in order to keep agricultural production running at full speed. And I think that image of an economy in which the things that slaves grow and slaves themselves as speculative property, as sites of investment in their own bodies, right, really makes vivid the degree to which it is an economy that is organized around slavery.
One of the other things that you bring out, I think, in the article that I think is important, there are many important things in this article that we don't think about, is that the way the American economy was built, you describe, our factories, the canal, the railroads that were built up, all the rest, these great financial investments that built America, were really built on wealth, as I think you were saying, as wealth was generated by the Atlantic economy. Talk a bit about that. I mean, how those two fit into one another.
Sure. Well, before the United States was the United States, but rather a set of colonies that were part of a larger British Empire, these colonies largely served either to grow commodities like tobacco there in Maryland or rice in South Carolina that would be useful to the British Empire, or to provide provisions to the very valuable colonies that the British maintained in the British West Indies, Jamaica, Barbados, places that grew sugar, which in the 18th century was certainly the most valuable commodity in the Atlantic economy. So the colonial economy of a place like Rhode Island or a place like Massachusetts was largely organized towards producing things that would be useful for slaves to consume far away. That's one of the reasons why salt cod is still such an important part of the diet of the British West Indies and a part of that cultural legacy. It's not because those Caribbean islands aren't surrounded by fresh fish, but rather because slaves in the 18th century, whose owners did not want to allocate labor towards actually food production, but solely towards the growing and processing of sugar, imported salt cod from the North Atlantic. And that means that small fishermen in distant colonies would be connected to slave exploitation and sugar production thousands of miles away. And so when we look at the wealth that helped build New England, when we look at, in particular, families like the Browns in 18th century Providence, we see wealth that is created not through the outright owning of slaves, though there was, of course, the outright owning of slaves. We see wealth not created through the actual transatlantic slave trade of moving people across the ocean, although there certainly was plenty of wealth created that way, but rather wealth primarily created through a provisioning trade and a shipping trade that moved slave-grown commodities from, you know, Maryland south into the Caribbean, across the Atlantic Ocean, and furnished those slave colonies with food and nails and candles and many of the other materials that were part of New England's economy.
And the other things that in this outline, I mean, in the article that you outlined, just kind of put on the table, again, is this piece you wrote, which actually was shocking, that the plantations themselves didn't just produce these economies, these commodities that, as you wrote, fueled our economy, but it was the business practices, you say, that he innovated. I mean, on the backs of human slaves. I mean, that was something that I think nobody ever thinks about. I certainly never thought about.
Yeah, this is absolutely important. But when we look again, if we transport ourselves back to the middle of the 19th century and ask, where are the sites in the American economy that have the largest scales of production? Where are the places that require the greatest degree of vertical reporting from the sites of production to the sites of ownership? Where are the spaces that require the most complicated financial instruments in order to facilitate expansion? Where are the places that require the most sophisticated forms of accounting in order simply to keep records of the bottom line? And time again, these questions direct us not to the mills and factories of New England, but rather to the slave plantations of the southwestern frontier in places like Mississippi, in places like Louisiana, where not only cotton is being grown, but also sugar as well. And it's particularly in sugar that we see the marriage of exploited agricultural labor with the most cutting-edge sort of processing technologies that makes slavery not a retrograde sector of the American economy, but really a front-edge sort of innovator in what we might call today agribusiness, but more importantly, in the realm of simply innovating the way in which accounting is done, in the way in which bottom lines are calculated. So if we want to look at sort of the concept of property depreciation and the degree to which that gets figured into accounting methods, it is not the railroads, which are typically given credit for this because of the huge capital expense that comes from building a railroad, but it is the slave plantation, where as enslaved people aged, as enslaved people became debilitated, owners could in fact depreciate that capital in their accounting methods. It's a haunting sight for the innovation that is so important to contemporary capitalism.
So, I mean, so many thoughts as you describe this. Let me, before I jump into them, talk a bit about the Civil War. I mean, you mentioned it briefly in the article that people thought the Civil War would destroy our economy because our economy was built on slavery. So when the war occurred, we thought it would fall apart, but it obviously did not. So talk about what you think politically was going on at that moment, and why it didn't fall apart, and what was actually going on at the brink of the Civil War, that in terms of what you've been researching about slavery and the rise of capitalism.
Sure. Well, again, I think we tend to looking at how the Civil War is typically taught in the United States, and this goes back to the very textbooks that populate classrooms, we have a chapter on the rise of the North, its industrialization, its social reform movements, the emergence of abolitionists. And then there's a chapter on the South and the expansion of plantation slavery, the rise of plantation culture, chivalry, and all of this kind of business. And then the next chapter is the coming of the Civil War. And it is though we have these two separate cultures that are separate from the moment the United States gains its independence, and that makes the Civil War, or at least a secession, appear to be almost inevitable. But when we look at the messiness and the integration of the sections, if we can call them that prematurely, through the 1820s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, if we follow the goods, commodities, ties of people, of ideas, of things between the regions, we see a United States that's much more integrated than divided than we would otherwise be led to believe by the war that will soon ensue. And yes, if we read history backwards and say, but look at the Civil War, look at its violence, look at its horror, clearly that wouldn't have happened if the regions were in fact as integrated as you say. This is the typical fallacy of reading history backwards, and mm-hmm. that takes away some of the surprise and sort of stunning horror of the Civil War itself. If in fact we read history forward, if we put ourselves on the ground in 1858, 1859, 1860, a moment when Americans had no idea what was going to be ahead for them, these ties between the regions seem much more important. And this puts our attention on a rather significant portion of American businessmen, particularly around New York in 1859, 1860, and even into 1861, who argued that we had to find a compromise, that we couldn't, as a nation, allow the South to secede, because without the South, the entire northern economy would come crashing down too. And it's in fact it's these advocates of compromise who go so far as in fact to seek constitutional amendments that will sanctify slave property in perpetuity to placate the South. It's these advocates of compromise who are in fact the most explicit people in coming up with data and making claims of just how important slavery is to the national economy. These are the people who come up with the numbers of, you know, $150 million of interregional trade each year, or that something like $20 to $30 million each year in shoes alone move from Massachusetts workshops and factories onto the feet of black and white Southerners. They're the people who really identify how central slavery is to the national economy.
So I'm curious what led you and your your partners, Sven Beckert, who wrote you were writing this book with, what led you to this story? I mean, what drove you to kind of begin to unearth all this?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, we are living in a moment when we are increasingly attuned to the relationship between consumers and producers, separated by great distance, separated by political regimes, and yet connected to one another through ecology, through humanity. And we might call this, you know, sort of the Michael Pollan moment, when the logic of the omnivore's dilemma actually infuses many of the choices that we make today, or at least ideally we make today, as we think about the consequences of where things are made and what things are consumed and how this ties people together in a system. And I think moving this logic back a century and a half or two centuries to think about the ways in which livelihoods in one part of the United States are connected to livelihoods in another part of the United States, to think about the connections between opportunities that will emerge in the North for people to do incredible things, connected to opportunities or lack of opportunities in the South, as an increasing percentage of the American population is laboring under horrific forms of violence. I think that simply it does take a current sensibility and ask about what the implications of that sensibility are when we use it to ask new questions about the past.
So what do you think that it says about us now? What are those things out that, as a historian, you know, sometimes history is just not history, obviously, about history. It's about who we are today. Talk about how you two think or talk about that, what this revelation, historic revelation, could mean to who we are now and how we behave at this moment.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the most immediate consequence has to do with the scale and scope of human trafficking in the present moment, and the degree to which we are living in a global economy in which millions of people annually are transported across national borders and for the purpose of the exploitation of their labor. And advocates and other groups who have studied human trafficking have pointed out that the numbers dwarf that of the transatlantic slave trade of 300, 400 years ago, and so that this is truly a crucial problem. And as we think then about the consequences of labor exploitation in distant locales for the kinds of goods that proliferate in the wealthy economies of the West, as we think about the huge array of choices that we have, ranging from, you know, our new iPads to the sweatshirts that we buy in college bookstores, to the coffee that is marketed under the label of fair trade. I mean, there clearly are consequences that come out of a historical mindset or historical sensibility to pay attention simply to the connection between producers and consumers across great distances, to the very basic decisions that most of us in the West make multiple times in the space of any given day.
And one of the things I was thinking about as I was reading your article was what it says about what the idea that human slavery is what helped build capitalism in America, in Europe, Western capitalism as we know it, the place we are today in the 21st century. And what it says about the culture of capitalism, the culture of capitalism, the culture of the mindset of capitalism. How does that speak to you?
Yeah, this is a crucial problem. And you know, I think one of the important things to point out is, of course, that it is not historically accurate to say that slavery and capitalism are really one and the same. It's not appropriate to say that the kind of exploitation of the modern day wage system is the same as the kind of exploitation that took place on the
right.
slave plantation. And I don't think we want to confuse that. And I think we also want to recognize that in the 19th century, a growing and politically significant group of Northerners came to criticize slavery as economically inefficient and to proclaim that an economy organized around the opportunity to chase the carrot would be more productive for more people than an economy organized around the constant use of the stick to beat work out of people. And I think they've largely been proved right. But that does not mean that in the 19th century that the kind of exploitation that took place on the plantation was not incredibly productive for the whites who controlled that labor and who reaped the benefits of it. But as we connect that and the, sort of these historical observations to the present-day sort of incarnations of capitalism, I think we do see certain kinds of continuities. We see the degree to which labor and the costs associated with labor are seemingly the places where the greatest economies can be gained for the greatest return for those who own factories or other kinds of businesses, which is why we see capital moving across the globe in order to find lower labor prices, or why in the United States we see increasing efforts to lower the power of unions and to resist the idea that that we need living wages or anything like that. So to some extent, the idea that labor is the ultimate commodity, and whether it is commodified by the hour or by the day or by the week or even by the lifetime, there are certain kinds of continuities in thinking about how labor is commodified between the 19th century and today.
One of the things that not to put this at your doorstep, Seth, but that and not to kind of, well, just as the, when we do these programs about where we are today and the world we're facing in the meltdowns of Europe and America and across the globe, I mean, this also in some, well, some of the roots of this speak to me anyway. Maybe you don't agree with this. Is that about the avarice, about the greed, about the quest for profit at the expense of whatever's around. And you see this up and down throughout American history, world history. But to me, one of the, as I read your work, and I'm looking forward to the book, it speaks to that. It speaks to that root of the system we live in today and how we have to address it as a society.
Yeah, I think that's right. And historians are, of course, loath to posit that there's some sort of human nature that exists across culture, across time, across space. And so the idea that the human being is fundamentally a greedy and acquisitive actor is not something that that historians would readily argue. They would say that such behavior has to be learned, and such behavior is culturally specific. And we would say that the idea of a sort of bottom-line mentality is something that emerged haltingly and unevenly in the West over the past 400, 500 years, but found particular expression in regimes where private property was sanctified in law and in which the state did not overly interfere in the ability of market actors to do what they needed to do to get ahead. And so that does point us to the United States, and it points us to the United States in the 19th century quite clearly, a moment in which, again, because cotton is the most valuable thing made in the United States, and perhaps the only valuable thing made in the United States, that, of course, cotton is going to be the site of tremendous speculation. Cotton is going to be the site of innovations in mortgaging practices by which enslaved men and women could be purchased on credit. And then, of course, worked physically in fields in order to pay off the loans that facilitated their purchase in the first place. We're going to see massive speculation in plantation lands in which the price of cotton 1 year down the road, 2 years down the road, is the basis for future investment. So not surprisingly, there are massive bubbles, and the panic that the United States experiences in 1837 is a tremendous example of that. And there's been a lot of scholarship, in fact, recently trying to create some connections between 1837 and 2008, looking at the ways in which rampant speculation, unchecked by government, leads to horrific human consequences in the present. You know, thousands, if not millions, of people losing homes in the 19th century. Thousands upon thousands of people being separated from their family members when the price of foreclosure or bankruptcy did not merely fall upon the white speculator, but upon the enslaved men and women he owned who had to be sold in order to cover those debts.
And that before we close, that's one of the things that's an interesting phenomenon, is when you talked about that crash of 1837, the financial crisis, and how it literally did lead to a larger way, the breakup of the slave family, selling slaves off to meet their debts, and that's a piece that I found absolutely interesting, having never made that connection before.
Yes, I mean that piece is truly disturbing and reminds us at bottom that slavery in the United States was not just a form of labor exploitation, but a form of property exploitation as well. And to that extent, capitalists, if we want to call people with money to invest in slave bodies capitalists, could in fact do so quite readily and then store money in the bodies of slaves and transport that wealth from, say, Maryland to New Orleans in hopes of better prices in places that had the more burgeoning slave market, which is why, you know, a place like Baltimore was such a leading site of slave exportation in the 1820s and 1830s, as slavery sort of dried up in Maryland, but grew to be more and more important in places like Louisiana. Savvy investors and speculators bought thousands of Maryland slaves and transported them overland and even on ship to vibrant slave markets in New Orleans. And the fact that this was a form of wealth creation and a site of speculation meant that when things went bad, it resulted at the end of the day in even more slaves being sold.
Yet another deep connection between Baltimore and New Orleans. They're all over the place.
Oh, absolutely.
This has been fascinating, and I look forward to further conversations over the course of the year and to your book when it comes out. Seth Rockman has been our guest, as Associate Professor of History at Brown University. He, along with Sven Beckert, who's a historian at Harvard University, are coming out with a book called Slavery's Capitalism, A New History of American Economic Development. The two of them wrote this article in Bloomberg called How Slavery Led to Modern Capitalism. And he's also the author of Scraping By, Wage Labor, Slavery, and Survival in Early Baltimore. And Seth, this is great to have you with us. We appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.